Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who's been attempting to mend his brain. It's Richard Herring. Hello. Hello, lovely to see you all. Thanks for coming. You're much better than last week's audience, and so on. Welcome to Rich Terry's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. Though I was hanging around with the ghost of Captain Tom the other day. He said he'd answer one question about the afterlife. And I asked him if ghosts had bum holes. He said he wasn't going to answer. He wasn't allowed to say. But he says he calls it Rahalastapa, so it wasn't allowed to say. I've been... the thing I was going to do last week that I didn't do, it's not worth doing, but I'm going to do it now anyway. Remember last week? Been working on some observational comedy. Who remembers COVID? What's that? Who remembers that? Who remember that? That's good, but we all wore those masks, didn't we? What was that about? Remember? Gone. It's all gone now, so it's... It's all gone now, so it's fine. That was the last week's joke. I've been attempting to cure my... I don't know if I've mentioned it. I've got aphantasia, which is... I've not mentioned it much. It's where you can't imagine things in your... My mind's eyes blind, right? So if I close my eyes and try to imagine anything, I can't, like, literally see it. I can still imagine things. That's why I've got such a long, fruitful career in comedy. But I can't see them in my mind's eye. But someone told me a way to cure it. But I tried to do it, and it kind of slightly broke my brain, and I'm scared to close my eyes now. So don't try and... Like psychologists told me, don't try and cure it. There's no cure, don't try and cure it. But you've got to... If you've got aphantasia and want to give it a go, what you're meant to do is close your eyes and, like, maybe rub your eyes or look at a light, and then for the next 10 minutes describe everything you can see. And apparently after 9 days, you can then see things properly. But I did 2 days, and then I started to feel really sick. And then Last night, when I closed my eyes at night, I got too scared and had to go and... It's like I've opened the door to another realm, David. I'm not sure. I saw a cake and it scared me. So it kind of works, but is it worth it? Is it worth losing your mind for? Now I'm worried I've broken my... I literally had a headache for about a day from looking at things. I saw, I had some fireworks and stuff. It was quite good. Is that what it's like for you? Just that you can see a firework anytime you want? Yeah, it must be amazing being normal. I've got to thank the people. Thank you very much to the people who backed this episode of Rahelastapur. Thank you. Commit or don't bother. Kevin Franklin, you are a cunt. He says, could he call me a cunt, please? It's very, he asked politely, so I did. Sparkles, I imagine is some kind of unicorn, said, please visit tangible.gallery. I can't tell you what's in there. I haven't looked. It's a tangible gallery. That's difficult for me. And it says Paul J. Lev here, but I'm sure it's Paul J. Levy who's unless there's another Paul J. Lev. It's unlikely, isn't it? It's got a double V here, but I'm sure it's Paul J. Levy. Thank you very much. A long-time supporter of the podcast. Doesn't say anything. Didn't want anything said to him. He's a prick. That's all I'm going to say about him. The prick for supporting me for so long. Thank you very much. My guest this week is probably best known for her role as Juliet Destiny in Nebuck 50. Is that what it is? No, Nebula. I can't read my own writing. In Nebula 75. That's why we're all here. Will you please welcome Samira Ahmed, ladies and gentlemen, from Nebula 75. From Nebula 75. Come in. Samira Ahmed. Hi, Samira.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm all right.
Good. Is this some kind of Gerry Anderson-style project, Nebula 75? I know you like Space 1999.
Yeah, no.
You or is it a different Samira Ahmed who shares your IMDb page?
Well, there is a Samira Ahmed who's a young adult novelist.
Right.
And I sometimes get mail for her, which I forward to her.
Right. But there's some acting credits on your IMDb page.
There's a very famous Egyptian actress who's about 90. She's like the Elizabeth Taylor of Egypt. And okay. Her name is Samira Ahmed.
Okay.
But that's not me either.
Okay. So you aren't Juliet.
I have to say, I actually did write an email to IMDb to say, I've not actually been in these Egyptian films. So I think it might confuse some people.
So were you in Nebula 75?
Yes, I was.
Yes, you were.
Sorry.
So stop trying to get out of it.
The people behind it, they came on front row during lockdown with Marina from Stingray. And yes. And they told me they were working on this. Well, they just made the first episode and they put it up on YouTube. And then they said, do you want to be in it?
Yeah.
And I thought they were just going to put my voice on one of their own puppets, but they made a puppet to look like me. They put my head on Lady Penelope's body, which is very creepy if you think about it. And they've given me her clothes.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I showed a photograph to my mother. You know what she said?
What?
She said, she's so lovely, isn't she? And you know, and I realised that my mother actually preferred the puppet me to the real me.
I think all mothers would prefer a puppet version of their children that they can control for
she's
always.
She's so glamorous. Thanks, Mum.
Well, it's lovely to have you here. You're a very serious journalist.
I know.
And,
sorry, don't
expect
any jokes. I don't do jokes.
So it's all right. You don't need to. I'm the Lembit Opik here. I'll do the jokes. You can just... look, there's a lot of things to talk to you about. I've just been listening to your fabulous documentary about Mary Whitehouse, which went out on BBC Radio 4, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
This quite recently?
Yeah, it was last Saturday, just before.
Right, okay. So it's still available?
It's available for a long time. And yeah. You can choose not to listen to it, as many people have, on principle, which I thought was hilarious.
Well, it's very, very interesting because, I'm sure most of you remember Mary Whitehouse. Maybe some of the youngsters don't know who Mary Whitehouse is or just think we're talking about the Bedell and Newman show of the same name. But she was sort of Twitter before Twitter existed, in that she was didn't like people doing anything rude and would complain with letters. I mean, I just imagine a world where she had Twitter.
She did more than complain with letters. There's a great... So I spent 2.5 months reading her diaries in the Bodleian Library. I found out that they'd been deposited there and I thought I needed a project after my employment tribunal in case I didn't win. And then I thought I'll do it anyway. And she complained about... She didn't just complain. She rang people up. So very early in the 70s, BBC Two showed, I think they did a sex education film where they actually showed two teachers having sex. And we're going to show it to school children. And she thought this was inappropriate.
That is inappropriate.
not least, because the lady wasn't wearing a wedding ring.
Okay.
And she rang up the controller of BBC Two. She managed to get put right through to his line. You know who the controller of BBC Two was in about 1971, 1972?
David Attenborough.
And she wrote this really detailed account in her diary about how, and then I told him this, and then I told him that, and he spluttered. And you could tell he was so terrified that I am convinced, and this is my theory from reading the diaries, it's my academic research, that phone call precipitated him abandoning a career as a broadcast executive and going back into the jungle where he felt safer.
Yeah. There were two teachers having sex on it. I don't remember this show.
So can I just say, so the thing about the 70s is people think, oh, Mary Oates is horrible. But it was really weird, the stuff that was being normalised in the 70s. That the idea that you would show quite young children, like, I don't know, maybe 12,
right,
two adults having sex.
And teachers. Why don't I get some... Were they just selected? You know, like, hey, it's you two, I'm afraid you're going to have to do it. You're signed up to be teachers.
But you know the teachers would be real exhibitionists that they'd have volunteered, didn't they? Yeah.
I want to something.
And
like
it was also a really I've actually watched the footage of it because they used it on It Was All Right in the 70s.
Right.
And it's really horrible. It looks, you know, like the way you imagine the 70s when people reconstruct it, and it's all like a really horrible nylon duvet cover.
Okay.
And everything's a bit shabby. Yeah. It's like that.
And a very 70s cock.
I don't remember the cock.
So, joy of sex, facial hair. And like the thing, like in the 70s, they allowed really ugly people on TV as well. That's the thing. Like if it was now, it would be two really fit teachers. And
you know,
right.
I have to say, I don't know quite how, but I knew someone who someone got hold of a Spotlight directory from the late 70s. And Jesus, you turn the pages, the teeth, the comb-overs, you know.
It was a better time. And academics were allowed to look, you know, as they are, hideous. They were allowed to be hideous. And now academics have to be beautiful as well. Think of the ugly people. Give us a chance. Just want to be on the telly. You've sort of got into trouble on both sides, right, with the Mary Whitehouse thing, because people have either got upset that you're being fair to her and saying that she wasn't all bad necessarily. I don't think that's completely true, because I think it's a fairly... there's some nice things about it, but it's fairly damning. Or people are just annoyed that you're daring to criticise Mary Whitehouse.
So I got kind of a couple of different kinds of emails. I got a first email about a week before the documentary went out saying, I think this programme is disgusting, it shouldn't be made. Yeah. But it was interesting because it was from... And I really understand it was from someone gay who really remembers her homophobia.
Yeah.
But I personally think, as someone who also remembers the homophobia of the 70s and 80s, that just to label someone homophobic and not to understand what influence they did have and the idea that someone might have a point on something else. And rightly, people don't want to listen to what she has to say. But she was a Christian fundamentalist. So depending on your point of view, you could argue that she was brainwashed and that's why she believed it, as opposed to what happens now, which is young people who just, you know, beat up gay people on the street because they want to. Mm. You know, and I just think they're all homophobic, but I think we can... Sorry, I'm going to be digging another grave for myself. I've done this. But
well, you can't
I just,
argue your way out
okay,
of this
so
stuff.
Okay, so I actually explained the premise of the documentary to someone at the Writers Guild the other day, and she looked at me. She's a really well-known broadcaster. She said, so you mean a nuanced argument that someone could be right about some things and wrong about other things at the same time? Good luck with that. And so I did have a lot of people complaining that, you know, it was like... Someone said it's like saying Hitler was nice to animals. And, you know, I just think bringing up Hitler is always such an easy shorthand to shut down a thing. But if you don't understand how she had so much success, you can't argue against it. And then I did have a couple of emails from Christians, one of whom had read I wrote a piece for the BBC News website, which is what really caused the fuss, because I basically talked all about how she anticipated all the issues around online harms and digital pornography. And this person had said, you said in your article that, you know, Mary was out of step with modern Britain. You know, it is not... Jesus was not of... you know, the modern world. If you know, we're at the step of modern Britain, then that is right. And she just basically, it was like Mary Whitehouse had been reanimated in this email, and it ended with, respond to me, Samira, were the last words of the email.
But don't you, I mean, I think Mary Whitehouse in the modern world would be so happy. It sort of feels like there's armies of people doing her work, which is to get, like, upset about anyone who isn't espousing your point of view. It doesn't necessarily have to be fundamental Christianity, though some of it is. But, you know, we've all become, you know, there's an army of people who are that judgmental or saying this thing shouldn't be allowed that they haven't listened to. Because if you listen to it, it's saying this was wrong, that she did this.
Yeah, can I just say, it was on Pick of the Week. I'm really proud of it. And it really is about all the things she got wrong as well as the things she got right. Yeah. And I interviewed her granddaughter, Fiona, who I have to say is so brilliant. And Fiona grew up in Italy. Her father was the eldest son. They moved to Italy. And so they didn't have a TV. And so when she came to stay with her grandmother as a child in like the late 70s, early 80s, she was like addicted to television. And Mary Whitehouse would let her sit in front of the test card for hours waiting for Play School to start. Isn't that sweet?
But didn't you do that as well? I used to.
Yeah.
I was in love with that girl on the test card. So if you're watching, if you're listening...
She is out there,
give us
know.
A ring.
You're married now, Richard.
I am married,
but you know...
Those
days are over.
I said to my wife when we had the match, if the girl from the test card... You've got to have a list. I mean, you've got a list. You've got to have a list.
Yeah.
You've got a list of five.
Who's hers?
The girl from the test. I can't have the girl from the test card on my list as an adult, though. Kind of that's right. The adult version, the girl from the test card, who I loved when I was also a child,
yeah,
and she's aged the same as me, so it's fine.
Okay. And who's on your wife's list?
I've got a few, but I think you know.
You don't want to tell me who's on your wife's list that she.
On my wife's list, she likes Sawyer from Lost, but she's basically got that in her husband, right? So. Basically the same. So if she squints a little bit, she likes Amanda Peet. I'm very happy for her to have her on her list.
Okay.
Do you know Amanda Peet, the actress?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's on my wife's list. I mean, if that happens, she has my blessing. Even if I'm not there to see it, just knowing it's going on will be enough for me. But yeah, no, you know, I'm too old now for that sort of thing. I'm nearly 55. Goes all drops off, doesn't it? I mean, literally for me, actually, started dropping off. I mean, what I found this is a sort of a bit of a spoiler for the documentary, but basically, Mary Whitehouse's lawyer, who was helping her prosecute all these things where they thought there was indecency towards children and homosexuality and stuff, was himself later discovered to be abusing children.
Yeah, so he wasn't discovered till 2017, but what I pieced together in the diaries, and it's kind of the last 10 minutes of the programme, is he suddenly pulled out of representing her on the case for the Romans in Britain, which is the big anniversary of this prosecution. And he rang up and he said, oh, you know, I've my consultant says I'm really ill and I got some mystery illness. And what had happened was some students at Winchester College had finally reported him to the school that he'd been beating them under the guise of kind of Christian guidance. They had to bleed for Jesus. And some of these boys were beaten so they barely had to wear nappies. I mean, sorry, it's really, really horrible. But the school didn't tell the police. There's a report that you can look it up on the web. Just search for Winchester College report, John Smythe, S-M-Y-T-H. And the headmaster, whose name is John Thorne, signed a gentleman's agreement with him when they got him to sign it, and it said, I will not work with young people again and I'll get some therapy. And then it said, and this letter will be shown to all subsequent headmasters. And that's what they did. And the children who he abused were kind of just told it's all been sorted. And he was told he couldn't visit the school again. No one told the police. Church of England never reported it. And the Ewan Trust, where this guy was a sort of chief executive, never reported it. And 2 years later, he moved to Zimbabwe and then South Africa, where he set up new camps and he did it to hundreds more boys. And they think one boy died as a result. And he died a year after he was exposed by Channel 4 News. But she didn't know. And I just think, I honestly think, this is my theory, if she had found out, I think it would have shaken her. And I think it might have changed a lot of things. It might have changed her faith. It might have, you know, because she believed she was on a mission from God.
I know, but it's also interesting, I think, that when, you know, that's often the case, isn't it? That somebody who's...
Hiding in plain sight.
Yeah, it's, you know, so they make a big fuss and it's like, oh, look over there at the Romans in
Britain. But the big thing is that all these institutions knew about it. And she really trusted the men who, despite the fact she often argued with men, she was 18 when women first got the vote, 1928. She's, you know, older than you realise. But she trusted the men who ran these places and they all covered up for each other.
Yeah. Well, you know, as we've discovered subsequently, throughout it, everywhere. But it's a very fascinating documentary.
Sorry, this is a bit darker than you.
No, it's all right. Look, this show has all. It has so many moods, doesn't it? That's the thing. It can be serious. I'm going to ask you if ghosts have bum holes in a bit. Don't worry.
It's fine.
It wouldn't be appropriate in this bit, though, to ask you. would that's why I'm very, I can do either. It's like Channel 4 News. Sometimes you do a serious bit and then you go, oh no, this funny thing happened. Not so much on Channel 4 News. You were very serious on there. Well, you know, but I don't you think that though? I think Mary Whitehouse would love the modern world.
Yeah, she'd love Twitter. God, she'd be on it all the time.
Yeah. And she sort of liked the attention. So she's a fascinating character. I mean, I just remember sort of hating that sort of stuff so much. Just the idea, you know, because I was always, it was about comedy being censored by people, you know, and as a kid watching, having comedians censored, I hated, and then as a comedian, I hated the idea that comedians were being censored. And now that's, you know, comedians are almost the front line of the worst. They're, people making jokes, they get taken out before any of the people doing the actual stuff they're joking about. It's sort of, it feels like, which is...
I just think it's weird that Twitter's turned everyone into... There, you know, like, we have millions of Mary Whitehouses out there cancelling each other. I got accused of being a white supremacist for making a documentary about Mary Whitehouse.
Well, that's good. I think that makes sense to me, Samira. Yeah. I'm glad you've finally been caught. That's it. Hiding in plain sight. That's the thing with you. And look, but this journalistic imperative has been within you from a very young age. You were like, you. One of the first things you did was wrote to News, John Craven's Newsround.
Yeah, in the summer they had a show called Newsround Extra, and they encouraged you to write in your own reports. And this is the days where you didn't know your letter was going to be read out. So I turned on the TV one day, and John Craven was reading out my letter. And then said to Lucy Marthon, what do you think? And it was about a racist attack that me and my friends experienced in a playground. And the most amazing thing was about 10 years ago, I got an email out of the blue from Lucy Marthon. And she said, was it you who sent that letter? I don't know how she'd remembered the name. But it had been really oddly handled.
Yes.
But also I bumped into John Craven at a Foot and Mouth Ministry of Agriculture News conference when I was a reporter at Channel 4 News. And I said to him, I got a Newsround Newshand badge from you. So, yeah, it was like a thing.
But again, it was sort of weirdly... You know, it's the BBC have done very badly in so many ways. And even though they were trying to be helpful and doing the right thing, it still sort of came out wrong, didn't it? And John Craven...
Oh, well, they said, it is very difficult. I'm sorry about your experience with the English children. This is 1978. But it's very hard to stop children being mean to other people. And Lucy, I think the reason Lucy got in touch was at the time, you know, she was the first Asian woman reporter on the BBC. There was a lot of things she was experiencing. She was very young as well. And she didn't want to draw attention to herself. So she sort of said, well, I think anyone who's different can experience things. And actually, what she wanted to say to me 30 years later was, I should have said, this is outrageous, it was racist, it shouldn't happen. And no one really knew how to handle it. So I think we are more honest about this. But the other thing I should say is, I mean, actually, even before that, you used to write compositions. I'm sure you've kept all yours. And all my school compositions in primary school were about things like being taken hostage by Baader Meinhof or the Red Brigade, because I used to watch the news and I used to turn it into stories.
Yeah, it was. I think that is a weird thing, and I don't know whether we protect our kids a bit more now or not, or whether it's just these things seep through anyway, but... I remember all the sort of nasty things.
Dark time.
The who was it? The Leslie Whittle, the guy there was the Black Panther or something. It wasn't called that. What was he called? There was a girl who got killed and was murdered by this guy who kidnapped her. What was he called?
To know. Well, you God, we don't want to talk about more murder. We just managed to get off Mary Whitehouse.
But that really upset. It was this heiress who was kidnapped and then murdered.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and it just really... And I was about 6 or 7. I think it was quite near where I lived at the time. And it really hung heavily on me because, you know, you were just hearing the news. And I guess the kids are sitting in the back of the car when I'm listening to news about the Ukraine at the moment and probably piecing things together, aren't they?
Well, I had my first child. I got offered a job at Channel 4 News just after I'd had the baby. And so I used to watch the news every night on the rest before I started the job. And I used to be giving him his bedtime feed, watching the news. And it was 2001, so it was just after the invasion of Afghanistan after 9/11.
Right.
And so there were explosions all the time. And when we took my son for our first fireworks party, and he saw, you know what he said? Look, mummy, bombs.
Right.
Because he was so used to seeing explosions on the news. And that's when I thought it might be showing him the wrong stuff.
Or the right stuff if he wants to grow up to be a top journalist like you. Get them in there early. Send him to a war. He's too old now to send him. I can send mine to a war zone. I'll send my 4-year-old son. That was fucking smarting him up, wasn't it? That's what they need, isn't it? That's what the 4 year when I was 4. In the war zones.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Look, I want to talk to you about, let's go on to a slightly lighter topic. You are you're the celebrity mastermind champion of champions.
But you did really well.
I did really well, yeah, but I didn't win. I got the highest ever celebrity mastermind score, 34, I think I got, and then I was beaten but within 2 minutes of having the highest ever.
I'm so sorry.
How many did you get?
I got 31.
See, I'd have thrashed you. Champion of champions,
okay, my story. I've got to tell you a story.
So
after I won, I was running for a bus, and the bus waited longer than it should have for me. And when I got on, he said, "That's for beating Giles Curran." By 1 point.
And then champion, I'm a House of Games champion of champions, you know, which I think is better than the mastermind. How'd you get on in House of Games?
I managed to win the fondue set.
Okay. I've got the fondue set.
Yeah.
When they sent me the fondue set, it didn't have Richard Osman's face.
Mine had the face, but didn't have a lid.
Oh. Maybe you and I should get together and make one good fondue set. And he lost loads of my prize. I had to, when I went on to the champion champs, I had to get the doll a second time because the doll hadn't turned up the first time because he knew what I was going to do with it. That's why he didn't send it to me the first time. Champion, I'm a champion of champions.
You are a champion.
No one
champions.
Can take that away from me. I wish I was a celebrity mastermind champion of champions. What other quizzes have you done? You done them all?
I've done Pointless, but I don't think it's been broadcast yet.
Okay.
But I'll leave you to guess how much.
You definitely won. You definitely won the jackpot. What you're a little done? Swat. pathetic. What a pathetic. MasterChef?
I didn't win that. I was really conflicted. No. I didn't want to do it. So right. My mother is a really good cook, not just a really good cook, but before Madhu Jaffrey, she was the first woman to cook on British television, like Indian food. She wasn't Fanny Craddock or anything like that. But she used to do the cookery on Pebble Mill at One, and she had two little BBC books. And in fact, the weird thing about the Mary Whitehouse doc is I've had all these emails from men saying, I learnt to cook from your mother's Pebble Mill cookbooks. I don't know what triggered the memory. But she used to come home and, you know, she'd be cooking for people like Sacha Distel and all, you know, the kind of cool stars on the 70s circuit. So she's still an amazing cook.
Yeah.
And so why would I compete with that? And, of course, everyone else on it was like they were soap stars and people for whom it was like a strategic career move. And I don't know quite why I'd done it. I think I'd just gone freelance from Channel 4 News, so my agent said, you know, it would be fun. And I'm of that generation. The idea of being judged on my cooking as if that makes me a better person is not something that seems natural to me.
No. So you didn't win, is all you're saying?
Yeah.
Can't take losing, isn't it?
I'm technically a quarter finalist, though.
Okay, that's pretty.
And then you find out he had to cook for.
I wouldn't be able to do MasterChef.
No, you wouldn't want to do MasterChef.
Well, I couldn't do it. I could make a cheese toastie. It's pretty good.
Yeah, well, you know, nowadays they all obviously have they hire people to teach them. So the year that I did it, was it Ryland? He did a gourmet version of a Happy Meal.
Right.
And there's no one telling me I'm going to lie about myself. Was that his idea or did someone... I mean, it's a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
You know, and he cooked it all from scratch and deep fried the kind of special chips. It was like a really luxury version of a Happy Meal. Okay. But that's the kind of gimmick thing that you need to do to win. Whereas I just thought, I didn't care what it looks like. Does it taste good? And they're really big on presentation. And then the food is all cold by the time they taste it anyway because it takes so long.
Right. Yeah, presentation is not my skill set. I have to say.
Yeah, and also my inspiration was, you know, Simone de Beauvoir, you know, she and Jean Sartre had this amazing relationship. And during the war, she used to cook for him occasionally. I think she felt quite conflicted too. And because, you know, during the war, it was quite hard to get fresh meat. She did eventually got sent some meat by a relative in the countryside, but it was rotting. So she cut off all the rotting bits and then sort of cooked it and then realised it wasn't very nice. And so she got a tin of mushroom soup and poured it over the top. And she wrote about all this in her diaries. If you read, The Prime of Life or whatever, there's this really, you know, laboured account of her trying to cook a nice meal for Jean-Paul. And you just think, what's the point? You're an existentialist, you know. So
it's gone classy this week, isn't it? It's gone pretty classy. I'll be on Channel 4 soon, don't worry. They'll replace Channel 4 News with this. What's going to happen? Let's talk about this is incredibly bold and brave. I mean, you are you're a very brave person in any case, I think, and very confident and believe in yourself in a way that everybody should. But the equal pay thing with the BBC was quite a big deal, right? You were presenting. Like not something like Points of View, but it was on the radio, right?
It's called Newswatch.
Okay.
And it's on BBC One and it has twice the audience of Points of View.
Okay, sorry, I beg your pardon.
1.8 million on Saturday mornings on BBC One. And basically, thanks to, you know, you not want to thank her, but Theresa May made companies have to publish their gender pay gap and stuff. And the BBC also got compelled to publish its top earners. And so all of us, like, we're investigative journalists. So you looked at the list and looked who was on it. And I remember seeing Jeremy Vine right at the top of all the news presenters on. And I thought, is Points of View actually still on? And I realised it was. And then I just thought, I think there's a case here. And so it took me a while before I found out. And, you know, I have to say, Jeremy was such a gent. He told me when I asked him. It took a while, but he did tell me what he was on. Which made it easier because there's no obligation for employers to tell you until you get to tribunal. And in that time, you're racking up legal bills and they can offer you a settlement. And if you don't accept it and you don't win, then that can be held against you. So, you know, there's a lot of risk. But I just treated it like a story and I just thought, I'm going to find out what's going on here. And I just knew that I wasn't being told the truth and they were never giving me a pay rise and all that. And also the biggest thing... I was in a union. You've got to join a union. So the NUJ backed my case and had amazing lawyers and they took it on. And so the thing is, you say I was brave. I wasn't because I didn't have to take the cost. The only thing, I mean, admittedly, I could have lost my job if it
Well, but also,
out,
you know, to like to take your employer to court is quite a risk. Right. So the BBC could say, oh, you've won. Well done. Oh, no, there aren't. We haven't got any more jobs left now. Sorry. They're all.
Well,
so
I did. I mean, obviously.
I mean, they get into trouble for that, probably.
Well, one of the things I did before I took the tribunal was I arranged to get put onto staff for Newswatch.
Right.
So that was, you know, you just work out what are your options and you plan things. And
how much more was Jeremy Vine getting paid than you were?
Well, I was earning 440, and he was getting per program. He was getting 3,000.
Right. Pretty good, isn't it? You're getting paid more than you get for doing this show. You get paid more than you get paid for doing that show. So that's pretty good, given this isn't on TV. And you get the same as the boys. Yeah, because I'm tight. Everyone gets the same. Nothing. They get a mug. You got that mug, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So shut up. Don't take me to court. And so the BBC lawyers were pretty bad, I've heard. And your lawyers are very good, and you easily won. That's what I heard.
It's true, actually. Yeah. I had an amazing lawyer. Yeah. She was like Erin Brockovich. She was just amazing. Claire
and
Darwin.
And has it changed? Has it then made material change to the BBC, that decision, or is it still a...
That's a good question. Well, they think 700 women got offered pay rises as a result of my case.
Right.
So I think... That's...
I don't like to use this word anymore, but it's ballsy. That's what I like to say. It's ballsy.
She's got ovaries, that's what you mean to say.
Yeah, exactly. And look, you've interviewed... Like, I'm so jealous of the people you've interviewed. It's absolutely insane in your long career. You've interviewed Paul McCartney, who's I've been trying to get on this show for a long time. See, it's not. He doesn't seem that interested.
I'm sure he'd love to come on and discuss this Bowel movie.
We'd have a good time. He's already talked about wanking in a room with John Lennon. And I haven't even talked to him yet. So that's imagine once I've talked to him, what we're going to get out of him. Is he nearly 80 years? Is he coming up to 80 years?
He's going to be 80 in June.
It's absolutely insane. So you've talked when you've interviewed him quite recently, right?
Yeah, November.
Wow. Okay. How was he? Was he nice?
It was absolutely brilliant. It was exactly... just imagine what it would be like to meet Paul McCartney. He was lovely. He was really charming, very generous. All his daughters were there, his grandchildren were there. There was a dinner... Play the piano, Lady Madonna.
Pretty good. We'll get him on. It's going to be a secret, and I'm not going to tell you he's on, and if you don't come and watch it, you won't see it. So you've got to buy tickets to every single... Maybe he's going to be the guest at the end of this series.
I'd like to interview Ringo.
Ringo? Yeah. That's got to be, you've got to be able to get Ringo. That can't be hard. I haven't even thought about asking him. I got you before I got fucking Ringo. What would you ask Ringo? Like, you've got to give me some tips on how to... Is that what am I doing wrong here? What would you ask Ringo Starr about? You're a big Beatles fan, right?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, what would you ask Ringo about?
I would ask him at the time he crashed his car near my house and made me late for school.
Did he?
Yeah.
He crashed his car into your house?
No, it was a couple of miles away.
Oh, okay.
Him and Barbara Bach, it was a Mercedes. We all knew it was a Mercedes. My parents were interested in that fact. And he crashed it into the Robin Hood roundabout on the A3. Okay. And all the roads were blocked. And it was really weird how everyone knew within an hour that it was a Mercedes. But you know, obviously it was when he was drinking. And I think they went into rehab, so it might have been a moment that changed his life for the better.
Probably doesn't want you to bring that up. I'm very tactful with my guests. I wouldn't bring that up.
I've interviewed people about their near-fatal car accidents.
I would too, yeah. I'd absolutely talk
you
about
would,
that.
Yeah.
I ask people all the wrong things. So there would be... What's your favourite... What's the favourite people you've interviewed? Oh, yeah, I see you've got... You told me you've got Sooty coming up. But you haven't interviewed Sooty yet.
So the great thing is on Front Row, since it's gone to 45 minutes, Tom Sutcliffe and I are the main presenters now, and we've been encouraged to sort of, you know, express our interests. And I noticed that Sooty and friends were doing just starting a tour. And I just thought, we should get Sooty on Front Row. And we are.
But only Sooty, the one that can't talk.
No, I think we might have to have Sue.
Yeah.
And Richard Cadell might make an appearance.
Okay. Who's doing it now? What's his name?
It's Richard Cadell.
Richard
so
Cadell.
Basically, I found out that there were tickets on sale. I booked my tickets to see Sooty at the Epsom Playhouse a year ago. And then I pitched it to Front Row as well. So.
When have you watched that show yet, or is it still yet to come?
It's yet to
come. When they're doing a live show of Sooty, is he just still that big, or do they bring a big? does he come out life size, or is it just you're watching a bloke like here?
It's still a puppet. It's still a puppet. Yeah. But I love the fact that I grew up with Sooty,
yeah.
And my children grew up with Sooty because my children were born in 1999, 2001, and.
Yeah. Yeah, you wait till the news comes out about him. The next generation aren't going to be. And they find out what Sooty was up to. That's
why. Didn't you raise your children to watch lots of 70s TV? Because I used to have lots of. We watched a lot of the goodies.
Yeah.
And my daughter, when she went to Brownies, they had to draw like pictures of their favourite shows. She drew a picture of the goodies.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And she actually thought that Bill Oddie's real name was Ecky Thump.
It's good. You know, the goodies are a great show. Whether you're into. Little House on the Prairie, but is that more the books than the TV show?
Yeah, I only read the books in my 30s, actually,
right.
After the the big crash, a lot of Americans started reading this book, which had been written in the Great Depression, and they were kind of nostalgic about, you know, the old pioneer days. They're actually quite dark.
Yeah.
They turn into kind of Grapes of Wrath by the last one. And I just read them, and I realised they were brilliant, and I made a documentary, and I went to the farmhouse where she wrote them in her 60s. And it was my... Sorry, I hate to bring it up again, but it was my first... My first subject on Celebrity Mastermind.
Well, if I'd done that, I would have easily got more points. If I'd done Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah.
It's eating the same language as you speak. I did Rasputin and I had to learn stuff in Russian. I can't even speak Russian, so I'm the best.
You've got two trophies, though.
But you've got the trophies, yeah.
Yeah, I've got two Mastermind trophies.
I know. Yeah. Well, give me one. I should be in Champion of Champions. That's ridiculous. I'm not allowed in Champion of Champions. I'm the third highest scoring person.
Have you had this argument?
No. I don't want to do it again. I actually still have nightmares about it sometimes still. I had a dream where I was on Celebrity Mastermind and the walk to the black chair was just full of mud. And I had to walk through this mud to get to the chair. That's how, and that was, it was really scary. Do you not find it terrifying?
No. So the thing about journalists is we're used to sitting, if you're TV shows, you're used to sitting, you know, in a room with a camera staring at you and having to just, you know, I mean, not usually people barking questions at you, but it's kind of my idea of fun is people shouting questions at me and I know all the answers.
Yeah. Not all the answers. You only got 31.
It's all that I needed.
But, you know, you're a journalist. You've probably been in war zones and stuff. So probably walking to a chair is not that hard. Rich, yeah, that's probably true. What's the fascination with Space 1999? Is it all of the Gerry Anderson stuff? Is it
that one in particular? Because I was seven when it started, and it was my show, and it was very dark. You know, like there was lots of creepy endings where people would wake up in suspended animation and realize that there was 70 years of space travel, and they were going to die inside a glass box, and you'd be watching that at 11:30 on a Saturday morning with man hammering, going, "Let me out!" So there was a sort of a genuine horror element to it, and I actually got to interview a lot of the actors from it who are still around because I wrote a feature for it about it. So the main thing I do, I mean, the great thing about my job is I basically seek out all the cult TV I loved as a kid and then just go and interview people who are on it. But I did like, the other one I really liked and it was very formative was I had an older brother, he used to watch Captain Scarlet, and in Captain Scarlet they had those angels who flew jets. And one of the earliest dreams I remember waking up, and I'd dreamt that I was one of the angels and I was a fighter pilot. And I woke up and I wasn't, and it was so sad.
You can be Samira.
No,
can
I can't.
Happen.
It's
you
too
can.
Late. I really. I wanted my daughter to become a fighter pilot, and then she changed her mind. But like, I actually arranged for her to meet, you know, pilots and things. Yeah. And whenever I would find myself talking to someone from the military, it was like, "Can I arrange my daughter to fly a helicopter with you, please, or something?" But she's decided she doesn't want to be a fighter pilot. But that's Juliet Destiny. Nebula 75 is named Destiny after Destiny Angel, and Juliet was her name.
I loved Captain Scarlet. That's one of my earliest memories. And Joe 90, those are my two favourite kid shows as a kid. I loved Captain Scarlet.
Did you have a crush on Marina?
On Joe 90, I had a crush on Joe 90.
On Marina and Stingray. Because I definitely
and the girl
fancied,
from the test card, it was fine. I was a kid as well, it's fine.
But the puppets were kind of grown up. I mean, the puppets and Thunderbirds were quite handsome.
Yeah. I liked, Aquamarina was nice, yeah. And Lady Penelope was all right, wasn't he? And Parker, didn't mind a bit of that.
He's still around.
Big Nose. He's still around, the puppet.
Yeah, the actor.
Yeah, okay.
The actor.
The puppet, you're the puppet.
I've interviewed the real Parker.
Yeah, Parker's still around, but he isn't like, was he young when he was being Parker then?
Well, he's, I don't know, he's about 40?
Right.
60 years ago.
60 years ago?
Because he's about...
So he's 100 years old?
I don't know. He's in his 90s.
You should ask him. Samir Ahmed, if you went into a chrysalis...
Oh, no.
Yeah, and you melted down a caterpillar, it could come back as anything in the world. Okay. Could be you, could be someone else, could be anything. Could be an object, could be an animal, could be you with improvements. What would you like to...
Okay, I actually thought about this when you asked it earlier. And this is the
last
first thought that came to my head. And I don't think it's very useful. Inner eyelids, like Mr. Spock in Star Trek. I don't know quite why, but they might be useful for blocking.
So what? Take me through the inner eyelids. So you've got two eyelids.
So you have two sets of eyelids. So you could avoid eye damage from an eclipse or something.
It's a waste of a fucking chrysalis, Samira. Get some sunglasses. Look at a reflection on a piece of paper.
You said the first thing you think of. That was the first thing I thought of. I don't know what.
You'd
I
like just some extra.
Oh, I know what I would like. I would like some real wings, like Maleficent.
Okay.
See, look, I heard some people like that answer.
Yeah, that's they were getting a little bit turned on by that idea of you being like a winged creature from Maleficent. That's good. And can you, as a journalist, can you answer? This is a question from my son, which you may have missed in last week's show. Do ghosts have bum holes? Do ghosts have bum holes? I don't know if you've understood the question.
Yeah, I think they do.
You think they do?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's. I don't think I have to ask anyone else. So you're a celebrity. I'll go to my son and say, yeah, they do. What, do you think they use them still, or they're just there?
Yeah, for ectoplasm.
Yeah. I think ectoplasm comes out of the genitals.
Oh, you've had this conversation already, haven't you?
No, well, I've...
with somebody.
I've thought it through. Yeah. I would say ectoplasm is a sticky subject. No, it's not like a pooey subject.
No, we're not going to talk about it.
It comes from a... I can talk about it. You don't have to talk about it. You brought up ectoplasm.
I was just trying to answer the question.
It's good. That's my... I'll come in with another one from my son. And this is another emergency question I want to ask you. This is a highbrow emergency question.
Okay.
So you're fine. If all the art galleries and museums in the world got together and said, we love Samir Ahmed and she stood up for equal pay rights and she did that thing about Mary Whitehouse, some of us didn't like it, but others did. Some of us thought it was good. We would like to give her, one piece of art or artifact from any museum or art gallery in the world. What would you choose as your prize from all the existing art? And
the portrait of Christina of Denmark, painted by Hans Holbein in the National Gallery.
Wow, you were right ready for that one.
You know who she was?
No.
She was a prospective bride for Henry VIII, so she's the one that got away.
Oh, wow.
And she was already, I think, widowed, so the portrait's in black. You'll recognise it.
Yeah.
She's dressed all in black. It's against a blue background. She's got a bonnet on. But there's all these little subtle details, like between the texture of the velvet and the silk and the gloves and the red ring. Okay. It's a portrait that intrigues a lot of people. And I saw it when I was about 10 on a school trip, and I was just fascinated by, like, it's a whole, you know, subjunctive history. What if? What if she'd married him?
Which, whereabouts would she have come in the...
Possibly around the Anna, after Jane Seymour, I think, okay. That kind of time.
Can't remember which one she was. She's in...
Number
from
three.
Dr. Quinn, medicine woman.
Oh, can I say... So, you know Jane Seymour, the actress?
Yeah.
She's amazing. She went to my school.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, and like, well, you know my school, and they talk about their alumni and stuff, and they named the theatre. They named the theatre after Margaret Rutherford, whose family actually, they all ran off to the circus after a couple of terms. They didn't even stay. She never even did a complete year. But they had Jane Seymour, who was a Bond girl at, like, what, 19? And they didn't name the theatre after her? And, you know, Dr. Quinn, medicine woman, they covered all kinds of interesting themes.
Yeah.
I love her.
Very good. I've got an emergency question about, did anyone famous go to your school? It sounds like, no, did anyone not famous go to your school?
Well, those are the two. I mean, I only found out about Jane Seymour
last
year, and okay. I think that's crazy that I did not know that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, if you had a Bond girl go to your school, would you not think you would want to know that?
Definitely.
Yeah. I've got a story about another Bond girl.
Go on.
So I used to live near Caroline Monroe, who was in, she was also a Hammer horror girl, he was in Spy Who Loved Me. And the thing about her was, as a child, you know, we talked earlier about how the 70s was sort of, there was a huge amount of sort of very sexualized advertising and culture. And she was the Lamb's Navy rum girl. And so you'd see her unzipping her catsuit and getting into a helicopter with a load of sailors. And I just felt like, this is really not safe. This feels really inappropriate. And being quite intimidated by that. And then, you know, 20 years later, I was living in Marylebone, and she lived nearby, and she had a daughter at the local school, and, you know, she was in her, I don't know, 40s. She's a middle-aged mum. She'd not had any surgery, but she was still unmistakably Caroline Monroe with these beautiful smoky eyes. And men used to see her on the street and stop her, and they'd be all starry-eyed, and then ask for her autograph. And she was just this mum going to the supermarket and picking her daughter up from school. And I just loved the fact that she's had a really successful career. She's one of the most beautiful women ever. And she used to have come... And I just had this whole thing that for some women... The 70s was just fine, and, you know, I think she had a good time.
Yeah.
I really like her.
It's good someone had a good time in the 70s. when you were telling me as well, you interviewed, Debbie Harry and Chrissy Hynde?
Yeah, Chrissy Hynde showed me how to pout.
Right.
I couldn't do it very well, but she said, she's so, you know, you think Chrissy Hynde's going to be really scary.
Yeah.
She's not.
She is.
What happened?
Chrissy Hynde came to my New Year's Eve party about 15 years ago and wasn't invited.
Whose house did she think it was?
She was looking for it was like quarter to midnight. I can't remember what year it was, but it would have been early 2000s. And I was standing in my kitchen, there was a party going on, we were waiting for, and then this woman walked towards, that woman looks quite like Chrissy Hynde. And it was Chrissy Hynde, and I went, what are you doing here? And she just ignored me and walked past and went round a circle and walked out. She was with Beth Orton as well, was there as well, I didn't know who that was, but she's a big deal as well. And they were looking for a house with a fountain in it, and we didn't have a fountain, so they just left.
So you knew it wasn't you.
So she's scary and horrible. Go and tell me why she's nice.
Because she was just really down to earth and accessible. And then when we did photos, she was up for doing photo, and she said, we should do one where, you know, you pout like a pop star, and she puts on that sultry look. And I just thought she, you know, really self-deprecating about the whole thing about being a sexy woman in pop. She didn't take it seriously. And I think so, if you watch all the old Kenny Everett TV shows, and I worked through the whole box set, because I interviewed Barry Cryer about it a couple of years ago, and... when they were performing, he would come on as Sid Snot and they'd all be performing with him. It was just that sense of having fun about punk and new wave, even when it was happening.
Yeah.
But, you know, I like her.
And what about Debbie Harry, who was surprisingly old. She was like in her late 30s when the Blondie were...
So, yeah, I wrote a whole essay for the New Humanist magazine about the elder stateswomen of rock.
Yeah.
And the thing about Chrissy Hynde and Debbie Harry, and they're all actually the same generation as Angela Merkel, so I did this whole comparison. But the thing about Debbie Harry was she was already in her 30s when Blondie formed. So it was almost like an art project. You know, she was part of that Andy Warhol art scene. Sorry, I've got a bit of a... Let's hope it's not COVID. No, I did a negative lateral flow test this morning, for what it's worth. But she was already in her 30s, and so it was a bit of a construct. And even Blondie, the name, was like... She worked in a beauty salon and they dyed her hair blonde, so it was all... She was very self-aware about playing the idea. So it was a kind of drag. Being Blondie was a kind of drag for Debbie Harry, and too many people don't get that, you know. So she's just wonderful as well. And she signed my copy Parallel Lines. So I have to confess, I have a lot of... Like, we have certain... You might notice we're doing one of all pop stars on Front Row. I had Tears for Fears on the other week. I just brought my records.
I mean, it's pretty nice. You know, I would... There's lots of people I'd like to interview that having a podcast isn't quite as good as working for the BBC in those terms. Of going, come on my podcast, Tears for Fears. Do you think they'd come on here?
If you're going to ask them questions about bumholes...
Well, I would, but that's how you get to know people, isn't it? We learned a lot about you with the Chrysalis question, didn't we, about your... One in two pairs of eyelids. We'd never have found that out. You'd never have found that out if you were interviewing yourself. and I was interested. Was this a documentary you did about David Bowie and him being like having a special popularity with Asian women?
Asian girls, yeah. So again, it's early 70s was kind of pretty racist time. And there's something amazing about David Bowie deliberately choosing to imply that he might be gay and, you know, to dress provocatively. And I was, you know, like, he was a pop star who genuinely terrified me at the same time as I loved his music. So there are not many pop stars you can say that for. And my mother decided at one point that she did like him. She called me into the living room once. He was being interviewed without makeup. And she said, oh, look, it's David Bowie. Without that makeup, he's so handsome. And he's so polite. And he just thought, I think she thinks he can be a really good son-in-law, like arranged marriage here. And I just thought, I just remembered that moment, you know, that sense that, again, he was an educated, a bit like all these other pop stars, it's an act, you know, and it's thought through and there's a motivation and all that. So.
Well, in the Mary Whitehouse documentary, you have the little clip of the suite. And the suite had really upset.
Have you ever watched the suite performing Teenage Rampage on Cracker Jack in front of a bunch of 8-year-olds? Because I actually went. You know, they do Missing Believed Wiped at the BFI, and they rediscovered this episode, and a load of the suite were there. It was really sweet watching it, and they had been told they had to do this, and they didn't want to because, you know, it's a kids' program, and it literally was 8-year-olds with their Cub Scout uniforms and everything. But they thought, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it properly. So if you imagine them coming on and, you know, in their leather and, you know, waving the mics around and calling on, you know, for a teenage revolution.
Yeah.
And you could see why Mary Whitehouse's National Vala vloggers, you know, basically they would log things at home and they'd write down the lyrics and they'd describe how they were being pulled with clenched fists, and they were very concerned that it might incite bad feelings among young people.
Yeah, well, it did. It got black. I was Brian Connolly was one of the first people I fancied. Not Brian Connolly, Brian Connolly, who's the half-brother of Taggart. Is that right?
Did not know that.
And they both died of drinking too much, didn't they? But so yeah, and they had that other guy dressed. The other guy was it Steve? The should know more because they're name checked, aren't they? That's my favourite intro to any song. You ready, Steve? All that stuff. That's yeah. Anyway, remember
time.
The sweet. Who remembers the sweet? Yeah, it's not a good one because everyone remembers it. Was I gonna? There was something amazing. Oh yeah, look, you're going to interview Margaret Atwood.
Yeah.
Which I'd really like to interview Margaret Atwood, but I can't. Because I said some stuff about her on another podcast.
Oh, okay, don't get me wrong.
But you can ask her about it. She's got a... she can sign autographs, like, remotely. She's got a magic pen.
Yeah, I've spoken to her about that before.
Have you? Yeah. I was wondering what else she could do with that technology. And now I can't talk. And she's my absolute favourite author, but I'd love to have her on, but she might find out. And then when I did that, someone who was like her... brother-in-law or something said, "Oh, I heard that. I can tell. I can ask Margaret about it." I said, "Please don't ask about whether she used wanks off people with her remote." With her remote.
You know, funnily enough, I don't think I'm going to ask
this. Give it a go.
This.
I mean, now I've got it in you, seeded in you. If I could hypnotise you, have you ever thought of just she'd be up for it? She'd find that
why
funny.
Why don't you come to the Royal Festival Hall next Thursday and ask it? We've I'm probably going, got audience Q&A.
I could put my hand up. I'm going to. All right, I'll do that.
Gentlemen over there.
I'll tell you what, I'll do that and I'll bring a tape recorder and then I'll just make that an episode. It'll be me asking that one question. Mark Abbott, Richard Herring, stop. well, look, what else do I want to talk to you about? Look, I want to talk to you about your most embarrassing, before we go, I want to talk to you about your most embarrassing time as a journalist. You've said this in three different interviews, so I know that you know what
three?
It
is. Three?
I've seen it three. It came up three times. Yeah, I've really...
Is this about the radio car?
Deep, yeah, it is. So tell
it's
us
really
about
horrible.
That.
Okay.
It isn't horrible.
Well, it's really embarrassing. So,
yeah, good. That's why I want you to tell it.
Okay. So it was 1992. I was on a three-month contract as a radio network news reporter, so reporting on all the radio national radio news bulletins. And it was when the IRA was still bombing around... Britain, and a bomb went off at Whitehall, and I got sent to find out what was going on. I was a duty reporter, so it's a bit like being on a taxi rank, and you're the last taxi left in the office, so Samira, go down. And I went down, and in those days, you didn't have mobile phones, and you didn't have, like, you know, you had to have a vehicle that parked, and it put a mast up, and the mast had to be within visual sight range of either Alexandra Palace or Crystal Palace transmitter.
Right.
So it had to be set in place. So I went down with the radio car and we parked it on the embankment. I knew exactly where it was. And then I went off to find the police and, you know, interview everyone. And then I went back to file my report in the radio car and it was not there anymore. And, you know, and I know where it, like, it had moved. And, of course, I didn't know. And it turned out they said, well, we moved closer because the cordon had moved. By the time I found it, it was 10 to midnight. I was supposed to file for the midnight bulletins. And I hadn't written anything and I was freaking out. So I tried to ad-lib my script. And although I wasn't going on air live, they have this thing called traffic where everyone in the whole BBC and all the regional newsrooms can hear reporters filing from all over the world. So it's like Samira Ahmed filing for midnight bulletins and reels. And you could hear me just sort of stuttering and stumbling and losing my way. And then the kind of duty manager, the head of home traffic came on and said, I think we might just use June Kelly's report for Radio 2. And, you know, it's like, and everyone had heard it. And the next day I came to the office and my boss said, you know, you're going to have to win people's confidence back after that. And I was so convinced that they wouldn't renew my contract. So I was halfway through a three-month contract that I got myself another job. And then they called me and said, we're going to renew your contract. And I actually had got myself a job. They started out World Service Television and I managed to get myself a job as the news anchor on that. So I did that instead.
Right.
But I did go back to being a reporter because being a reporter was what I really loved.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was awful. And it was kind of thing that did give me nightmares, you know. Imagine losing a whole vehicle and like.
Well, it's like a nightmare. That's the sort of nightmare you have. It's not, you know. I'm sure as a journalist, the journalist version of the actor's nightmare, where you you have to go on stage without a script or if it's actually happening.
Yeah, and of course now, you know, I'd be much quicker at being able to devise a script, and you know, you know, I wouldn't quite say ad lib it, but I would have been able to turn around a script in a couple of minutes because you've been doing it for so many years.
And so if you're doing that, if you're, something's just happened and you've got a report on it, and you write a script and then you just have learned it as you've written it, you're allowed to read it.
You'll be reading it down
the
line.
Because it's the radio.
You know, so if you turn on the radio news, you know, they say, you know, so-and-so reports from the scene, and then you give them a 40-second or a 1-minute 30 package or whatever, but you basically have... It's a pre-recorded bit of track.
Yeah.
And it's turned around and played as a clip. So it's different to being live at the scene. I mean, I could have done that if they'd asked me, but they didn't ask me that. but no, it was... You live and learn.
And you were in LA during the O.J. Simpson
stuff? Yeah. Oh, I had some good stories there. So I did that case. I also... Madonna had her baby, and her baby was delivered by... Do you remember Heidi Fleiss, who was quite famous Hollywood madam?
Yes.
Heidi Fleiss's dad was Madonna's obstetrician. It's just one of those random facts you put into a bulletin about the baby being delivered by her. But the thing that I remember really well is... I'm not saying I met Madonna, but Madonna had a stalker. And, you know, we take stalking much more seriously now, but the laws came for California where actors did get murdered sometimes by stalkers. And this man broke into our house and... He must have loved it because she was forced to come to court to identify him. And all the reporters from the British press were there and they all went on about what she was wearing and stuff. But I knew what it was to have to sit in a room with this man who wants the attention, who's, you know, not well, and have to identify him. But she did look amazing. You know, she'd obviously chosen her outfit really carefully and all that stuff. I like Madonna a lot. So she's someone I'd like to interview, but I know she'll never give an interview. And that's why she's making a film of her life, where she has complete control.
Right. Have you tried to get to interview? You just know
no,
she won't.
But like she's someone like, you know,
I'm gonna get her on this.
No, I won't.
I'm gonna get her on this.
You are gonna get her on
this. Yeah, I'm gonna get on this now.
Okay, when you get her on, I'll definitely come.
No, I'm not gonna let you in. Unless you get me sooty.
You can come to the Epsom Playhouse. I've got a plus one.
Okay. It's a date. At last, I've got you, Samira. I asked Samira out at university, which she then when we were on Have I Gotten Used to You together, then brought up. Didn't you? She said no. She said,
and you said it was worth a try. And then went straight on to the next woman and asked her.
That was my technique, and I have to tell you guys, doesn't work. Whatever anyone tells you, it's no good. You know, you can't blame a man for trying, or a stupid little boy for trying. Can't blame a stupid little boy for trying. Yeah, let's go and watch Sooty. That'll make up for all those years of regrets. If I can get Amanda Peet round to my wife's house, and I say we will be my wife's house by the end of this podcast. Oh God, why do we? And how was it reading the news on Channel 4? That must have been a big.
It's not that big a deal.
Come on, did you ever feel like just making something up and slipping in something that wasn't...
Well, I had a thing where, you know, a friend would set me a word to work into the bulletin and I would get it on.
Okay.
Like hot tub. The hot tub of the caldera in this volcano that's exploding in Italy, for example.
Very good.
I think people overrate news reading, but it's quite fun. I did have
not
my worst...
Jeremy Paxman doesn't. Jeremy Paxman was on this and he says newsreaders are...
I know. But I did... I mean, you know, you talk about anxiety dreams. The one real anxiety dream I've ever had was I dreamt that I had to read the news for a special bulletin to mark like a BBC anniversary. And I had to read the news in the Albert Hall.
Right.
And I walked into the Albert Hall and I walked down, you know, the stairs where the organ is and everything. And I could see, I could identify like... the Queen, the Director General, the Prime Minister, my mother. And then I looked at the script, started to read, and I thought, you know, I've been chosen to do this, and it was gobbledygook, and I'm shuffling the papers, trying to make sense of it. That's the kind of anxiety dream that you have if you read the news, because there's nowhere to hide. But as we were told when I was a news trainee by the wonderful Phil Ashworth, you're not landing jumbo jets. Doesn't matter. What's the worst that can happen? You just look an idiot, but no one's going to, you know, be injured or anything.
And did Channel 4 care about if like the Queen died? Were you all prepared for if like a terrible thing, like an awful thing like that?
What will you do?
Well, in the BBC, had to run. Jeremy Paxman had to run up to a different floor to get changed into the right suit from a cupboard. I don't know why they didn't just keep the suit near the news desk. That's the first thing I'd have done.
There is a cupboard with obit jackets in.
Right. Yeah.
And I used to do rehearsals at the BBC. Yeah. We used to have obit rehearsals where they'd have scenarios about which of the royal family had died in an overturned Land Rover in Africa or something.
And you kind of hoped to be Prince Andrew, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, if it was Prince Andrew, you'd go, this is good news, everyone. This is, and finally. Ah, poor old Prince. Oh, lay off Prince Andrew. Oh, he's had a hard time. What's coming up? So have you got anything exciting in the pipeline?
I'm always pitching more documentaries. I want to do more documentaries about pop music.
Yeah.
Possibly about some interesting women in pop music. And there's, I don't know, Front Row is quite exciting.
Yeah.
You know, getting interesting people on. And... I don't know, I don't want to say anything else really because I don't know, it might not happen. But I'm trying to write a book, but I don't know. It's a weird time to be writing a book.
Yeah. Why is it a weird time for writing a book?
Because of all the kind of culture war stuff. People are very, as I found out with Mary Whitehouse, people have strong opinions about what should and shouldn't be, opinions that should and shouldn't be discussed.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
What do you want to discuss?
Well, I wanted to talk a bit more about Mary Whitehouse and the culture wars. So that's why I made the doc. I thought I'd get that out there. And no one can.
But you know, you're brave enough to take people on, aren't you? You don't care about what people think about that. I think the thing with Twitter is it's so you feel like a lot of people are. That's why Mary Whitehouse worked, isn't it? Because you can just get a small group of people and get them writing letters to the BBC or tweeting to someone, and it feels like an avalanche if every 20 opinions are the same and one says, no, it was good. And so it's just a small amount of people organising for most of these things. And I think even the things that are really controversial, when you block a few people, I blocked a few people about one subject that is slightly controversial.
Oh, is it that subject?
No, it's not. It's like a subject. And now I don't get any information about that at all. So it's, I wouldn't say I've blocked maybe 20 people about it. And my life is good again. So,
can I say, you found the right, you've got that, I really like your hair.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's too late to start flirting with me now. It's 30, you're 36 years too late. Look, it's lovely. Let's go backstage, have a quick one, and we'll let's have a. I've got to drive back. See, my. I wish I had the energy. It's really lovely to see you.
Please change, Ava.
It's really lovely to see you, and I think all of this stuff's so amazing, and your career's so amazing, and there's so much.
I still can't believe. I don't know why he asked me on, because you had Paul Chuckle. Why would you invite me? I don't understand.
I got Paul Chuckle, and that's it. It's all downhill from Paul Chuckle.
I'm very low rent substitute.
Because you've taken on the BBC Equal Pay, you've done this Mary Whitehouse documentary, and all this other fantastic stuff we've just heard about. That's why you are here. Ladies and gentlemen, give a massive round of applause. The incredible Samir Ahmed. Look at that. They love you. About one ticket left for next week, I think. So come along, see us online.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Samira Ahmed. Thank you to Scamp Regard, who play the music in these titles. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. I'm indebted to Chris Evans, not that one, and everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre and everybody who knows me. I'm very much indebted to the backers of the Kickstarter campaign, who this week are Teresa Ankin, Steve Pagioli, Adrian Stirrup, Cheryl Harris, Ewan Duncan, Martin Thompson, Damien Titchborne, Laffer, Claire C, Helen Previtt, Rob Fellows, Diana, Rex, Richard Alsop, John McCauley, Mr. P. Kenny, Mothy Bond, Roy Lake, Bob Sharunkle, Stuart Lee, Mark Granger, David T, Chris Jackson, Steve Webb, Titus Tabernacle, Morgan Evans, Sam Turnbull, Connor Mayer, Mike Pepper, Michael Anderson, Denners, No Need, I Just Wanted the Season Pass, Jean-Philippe Desir, Kieran Walsh, I don't know if that's all one person, Jean-Philippe Desir, Kieran Walsh, or Jean-Philippe Desir and Kieran Walsh, and of course, Glyn. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz on GoFasterStripe.com production. Head to richardherring.com/gigs to find out if Rahalastapa is coming anywhere near you. Lots of gigs still to come, including the Edinburgh Fringe and another run at Leicester Square Theatre in the autumn. richardherring.com/gigs.
Hold up.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.